You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie in the US.
And I'm Johanna in Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Every Friday, we present to you another tale of mystery, murder, and the macabre throughout history. And hopefully, every week you tune in on your favorite podcast app and listen to us talk while you sip some coffee or tea or absinthe.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of a favorite podcast app, Johanna and I just had the biggest, I don't even know how to say it, like,
Jenna Simpson moment.
I know. We just had a moment of, like, it was a facepalm for me. It was just such a facepalm. Listen, do we need a manager? Yes. Can we afford a manager? No.
No.
It's fine. We're fine. But what we realized is that you can leave comments on Spotify and we can see them.
We knew that part.
We did. But like when that first started, nobody was leaving any comments for us on Spotify. There were just none. So we just remembered that that was a thing. And oh my goodness gracious, it was like Christmas and a birthday all in one. There were so many really, really lovely comments under our episodes, and we had no idea that they were there. So,
yeah, we are so sorry that we completely ignored our Spotify listeners. And there are so many. We have so many listeners on Spotify.
It's amazing.
Thank you. Also, big shout out to Lisa from Texas and to everybody else who took the time out of their day to leave us a comment. I don't think we can reply to your comments there, but you have to know we read them now. We read them all and we are very thankful. Also, sorry to the listener who got very upset about the Slumdog Millionaire episode. We can't promise to do better in the future, though. I'm sorry. It's going to happen again, I guess.
No spoilers. All we can say about that is there are always going to be a few people who don't understand an homage. Let's just leave it at that, because if you know, you know. And if you love our Christmas episodes, then you understand. But that really was just the coolest thing, finding all of those comments in a really, really hard week. I'm so sorry I wasn't here last week. We lost my birth mom's husband very suddenly and unexpectedly last week. He was just a wonderful person and an amazing bonus dad. And I'll talk more about him soon. But finding those comments on Spotify was really so nice. Also a reminder, if you do listen on Spotify, please enjoy the Fresh Hell mixtape, which mixtapes are my love language. This one is epic and contains all genres. If you want to hear more information about how to leave us reviews on Spotify or how to support us in other ways, listen until the end, please, because that's when we'll tell you more on that. Let's get into today's episode. Johanna, would you like to tell these beautiful people what we're going to be discussing today?
Well, this week is all about love. Love. Kind of. So next week is Valentine's Day. Yes, I say Valentine's Day, like I say vampire.
Oh, I love it. It's my favorite thing.
And so we thought it might be fun to talk about that. And we did the research and we'll tell you all about it. This will be partly a lighthearted episode, but not the whole way through. First question, do you and Paul celebrate Valentine's Day?
Not really. Generally speaking, I'd prefer to do a nice meal on a different night and get flowers on a less expensive and price-inflated day, but occasionally Paul has surprised me.
I never have celebrated Valentine's, not in any of my relationships. That worked out great for me and my partners because apparently they were also not into it, or they hid it really well, because I'm not too much into most romantic stuff. Also, I'm a notorious wedding anniversary forgetter. I'm the worst.
I'm a huge romantic. I love all the romantic stuff. I'm a huge romantic, but Like, let's just go a different night. Like, not the night every single person in the world is trying to prove something, you know? I'm fine. Bring me home, like, some candy or a nice muffin or a donut.
This wouldn't be fresh hell if we wouldn't talk about what is Valentine's, when and where did it all start, and who the fuck even is Valentine? To answer all these questions, we need to travel back almost 2,000 years to the 3rd century, to ancient Rome, because that's where it all started. So first things first, who was Saint Valentine?
Who are these people?
Who are these people is the right question, because it appears that there are actually 3 different Saint Valentines, and it's all a bit mysterious and shrouded in the darkness of days long gone. We have Saint Valentine of Rome, who was a priest in Rome during the 3rd century. Then there is Saint Valentine of Terni, also often referred to as the Bishop of Interamna. And it's actually quite possible that Saint Valentine of Terni may be the same person as Saint Valentine of Rome. However, due to the lack of conclusive evidence, they are often treated as separate individuals. And the third one, the 3rd Valentine, he died in the Roman province of Africa, which is pretty much nowadays Tunisia and Algier. And this 3rd Valentine is sometimes mentioned in historical records. And like the others, the details of his life and martyrdom are not well documented. And it is unclear if he is a distinct figure or, again, possibly the same person as one of the other Valentines. So we have 3 Valentines or just one. Who can say, or maybe no Saint Valentine at all? That's the problem, we just don't know for sure. But for the sake of this episode and for the sake of Valentine's Day, let's assume Saint Valentine did exist and it was actually one person and the legends and stories about him are true. What made Saint Valentine the patron saint of love? Actually, not only the patron saint of love, but also engaged couples, happy marriage, the patron you pray to if you don't want to be fainting. He's the patron saint of beekeepers, of mentally ill people. Mm-hmm. He's responsible for fighting the plague, epilepsy, yeah. And he's also the patron saint of the island of Lesbos.
Nice. That sounds very
That's
relevant.
That's quite a mixture, yeah. Very eclectic.
It's an eclectic, relevant mixture to myself. I am a happily married, chronically ill bee lover with some mental health problems who faints a lot. And I love islands and am friends with a lot of lesbians. So it's good. I'm down with this saint. Tell us all about Saint Valentine. This is great.
The story of Saint Valentine goes as follows. There was a priest named Valentine in Rome during the 3rd century, during the rule of Emperor Claudius II. And apparently Claudius II was very firm in his belief that single men would make better soldiers because their mind wouldn't be at home with their wives while fighting the Goths and other invading barbarian tribes. So he issued a decree stating that soldiers were from now on forbidden to marry. But that didn't fly with Valentine, and the Christian priest defied this decree and continued to perform marriages for young couples in secret. He believed in the importance of love and marriage and was willing to risk his life to help couples unite in matrimony. According to another version of the story, Saint Valentine may have been involved in helping Christians escape harsh Roman prisons, where they were often subjected to torture and brutal conditions. In some accounts, it is suggested that Valentine was imprisoned and sent a note to a young girl he had healed or befriended or something like this, and he signed it, "From your Valentine." An expression that is believed to have originated the tradition of sending Valentine's Day cards.
You really pronounced the V there. You didn't say Valentine's. That was a really V. It was a
really?
I
can't hear a difference. It's all the same. Eventually, Saint Valentine was discovered, arrested, and brought before the emperor. And despite attempts to convert him to paganism, Valentine remained true to his Christian faith. He was sentenced to death and executed on 14th of February, pretty much around the year 269. While the historical details may be somewhat unclear and there may be different accounts and variations of the legend, the common thread in these stories is the theme of love, compassion, and the willingness to defy unjust laws for the sake of love and commitment. And that's basically how Saint Valentine became associated with the celebration of love and affection. And the day of his execution, so the 14th of February, I think he was beheaded by the way, is now celebrated by people gifting flowers and chocolate to each other. And if that isn't some macabre celebration, then I don't know what is.
Valentine's Day might even have had a more macabre origin, the pagan festival of Lupercalia. That was celebrated annually in the middle of February, and we know the Christian church liked to take already established holidays from other religions and incorporate them as part of the conversion.
Which I think is very smart, and which is one of the things that made them so successful in the beginning.
So smart. That's right. You're still celebrating when you're used to be celebrating, right? When you're used to celebrating. Very smart. Lupercalia was associated with fertility, purification, and the protection of livestock. It was observed in honor of Lupercus, the Roman god of shepherds, and it also paid tribute to the she-wolf Lupa, who, according to Roman mythology, nursed and cared for the abandoned twins, Romulus and Remus, in the Lupercal cave. The festival had a ritualistic and symbolic nature involving the participation of priests known as the Luperci. The celebration typically took place at the before-mentioned Lupercal, located on the southwest of the Palatine Hill in Rome. Sounds great, right? Wrong. This is terrible. Okay. How did the Romans celebrate Lupercalia? Goats and a dog were sacrificed during the festival.
I don't like that.
No, it makes me very upset. I understand that the festival is for the protection of goats by dogs and shepherds, so I understand the deep symbolism of it, but obviously. You know what? I wonder if modern-day Wiccans still do things like this, but you could do it easily with just hair. You know, clean out those brushes and save hair.
Something like that. Yeah, true. Yeah.
So, unfortunately, no. In this case, there was
different
goats
times.
A dog that would be sacrificed, but it gets worse. So, stay with us here. So then the blood of the sacrificed animals was smeared on the foreheads of the Luperci, and they would then cut strips of skin from the sacrificed animals and walk around naked, whipping women with those strips of skin. All in the name of fertility and purification, of course. Nothing makes me feel more pure than being...
And fertile.
Gently and fertile. It does. It makes me feel both pure and fertile. Most of the women would willingly line up to be sort of touched by the strips of hide, as it was thought to enhance their fertility and promote a healthy pregnancy. So it wasn't a whipping like cracking a whip. It was just... It was like a naked guy is going to slap you with a bloody piece of sacrificed goat. You cool? You down with that? Because it's really going to get your loins a-quivering. But yeah, they were. They were happy about it. Because in those days, pregnancy and childbirth were so fatal that you would take every single bit of help you could get if it meant the possibility of a safe delivery. And again, it's possible that Lupercalia was the origin of Valentine's Day, but it's also possible that it had nothing at all to do with it. So, listen, historians don't know what's true. We don't either. We just want to present to you the facts.
Well,
as we know them.
The fact is, I mean, the matter of fact is that historians are not even agreeing on if the Lupercalia took place that way.
Right.
That is something you realize when you read and research a lot of history. There are many, many, many uncertainties. There are rarely absolute truths in history, especially when it's been 2,000 years and more. And a lot is just interpretations of the findings.
Some things we don't know, and some stuff we're still finding out, right? In the 5th century, Pope Gelasius I, who was very much opposed to the Lupercalia celebration, coincidence? I don't think so. Made the 14th of February the official day of St. Valentine. And that was it for a few hundred years. It's not like St. Valentine got his day and immediately couples started gifting each other chocolate and diamonds, right? That only started in the Middle Ages. And during this time, the concept of courtly love flourished, influencing the cultural expression of romantic sentiments. This is my jam right here. The notion of chivalry and the poetic idealization of love inspired the exchange of romantic messages and tokens. Also, that's around the time when February 14th became associated with love due to the belief that it marked the beginning of the birds' mating season. One of the early references to Valentine's Day is found in Geoffrey Chaucer's poem Parliament of Fowls from 1382, where he links the day with the mating of birds and the celebration of love, writing, quote, "For this was on St. Valentine's Day, when every fowl come there to choose his mate," end quote. Chaucer's writings played a crucial role in popularizing the idea of Valentine's Day as a romantic occasion. So the natural occurrence of birds starting the mating process and nesting process in early spring, combined with the influence of courtly love literature, laid the foundation for Valentine's Day as a day to express romantic affection. The medieval practice of exchanging love notes and tokens gained momentum among European nobility. Aristocrats exchanged handmade cards adorned with intricate designs and heartfelt verses, contributing to the gradual association of Valentine's Day with the expression of love. By the 15th century, the tradition of sending love notes or valentines had become more widespread. These valentines were often beautifully decorated with symbols of love, such as hearts and Cupid, and were exchanged between lovers or hopeful suitors. The Tudor period in England saw the rise of elaborate and decorative handmade cards. Of course, with advancements in printing technology in the 18th century, commercially produced Valentine's Day cards became more accessible. The Industrial Revolution contributed to the mass production of cards, making them a popular and affordable means of expressing affection.
Capitalism.
And let's not forget one of our most beloved eras, the Victorian era. As we know, the Victorians were known for their sentimentality, and it's no surprise that they loved elaborate Valentine cards adorned with lace, ribbons, and colorful illustrations. These became highly fashionable. The exchange of cards grew in popularity across social classes, and the practice extended beyond lovers to include friends and family.
It's still like this in Mexico. There, Valentine's Day is El Día del Amor y de la Amistad, so the day of love and friendship, and friends do send each other little messages on Valentine's Day. It was very unusual for me when I moved to Mexico and saw this, but I think it's honestly really great. I mean, after all, there are different kinds of love, not only romantic love. I think the ancient Greeks differentiated between at least 6 kinds of love and philia. So the love between close friends is one of them.
That's right. It is funny. In Spanish, there are some different ways to say I love you. And, well, like in German too, right? Because the way you say I love you, IHOP, well, it's not even IHOP. That's our bastardization of a different thing.
There's a difference between ich liebe dich und ich hab dich lieb. Yeah.
That's right.
Und ich mag dich. It's different for every kind of love. Yeah.
Yeah, whereas all we really have in English is the difference between I love you and I'm in love with you, which it would be weird if like every single time I told Paul I loved him, I was like, I'm in love with you. I'm in love with you.
That's so funny. Philip and I do differentiate between that. Like we always love each other, but we're not always in love with each other. Like in love is this kind of acute and loving each other is chronic.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I think that's yes, because that's exactly how relationships are.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And then sometimes I feel so deeply and crazily in love with him, and then I have to tell him, and the other way around.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. I'm a huge believer in celebrating platonic love, too. My close friends and I go on anniversary trips as often as we can. Galentine's Day for Parks and Rec fans, you know? Now I want waffles. So, in the 19th century, the UK played a significant role in exporting the Valentine's Day tradition to other European countries. The romantic sentiments associated with the day continued to spread, and variations of the celebration emerged in different cultures. Immigrants brought Valentine's Day over to North America, and from there it was brought back to Europe by soldiers during the two world wars.
Yeah, and it was definitely in the 20th century that the day gained more widespread recognition in Europe. In the post-war era, the commercial aspect of the celebration, such as the sale of flowers and chocolates, became increasingly popular. So basically, you take something from Europe, commercialize it, and bring it back here. Smart. Yeah. It's very smart.
And they had America. America! Yeah.
Nowadays, the commercialized version of St. Valentine's Day is celebrated throughout the world, and it's either based on the beheading of a man or women getting whipped by naked priests. Before we get into some more macabre and tragic story, I see this is a perfect moment to take a quick break for a word by our sponsor, The Art of Crime.
Hellions, we're so excited to promote this podcast because we love it. The Art of Crime is definitely the perfect podcast for true crime and history enthusiasts. So if you haven't tuned in yet, you really need to get on it.
Yes, please get on your podcast app and queue it up already. We already introduced you to this captivating podcast during the first season, where host Gavin explored the shadowy world of art suspects in the Jack the Ripper case, followed by a thrilling second season on assassins and their intriguing victims, from Frida Kahlo's Casa Azul to the attempted murder of Andy Warhol. The Art of Crime covered it all, including the infamous assassination of Abraham Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth.
You might have listened to our episode where we talk about Clara Harris and Major Henry Rathbone, who were with the Lincolns at the theater. Well, in The Art of Crime, you can hear everything else about the night that Lincoln got shot. And that's not all. Once you're caught up with the previous seasons, you have a whole new season to binge, and it's just as riveting. Prepare yourselves, mystery lovers, for The Queen of Crime. This season unravels the life and legacy of an extraordinary figure, Marie Grossholtz, better known as Madame Tussaud.
This season explores the vex-coded world she created, delving into the macabre tales that made her famous. We all know the name, but few understand the historical significance of her vex museum. The more you learn, the more you appreciate how she revolutionized the true crime genre. From pre-revolutionary France to Victorian London, The Art of Crime peels back the layers of Tussaud's fascinating career. Learn about her royal patronage, her narrow escape from the Reign of Terror, and how she became a celebrated showwoman in London. The latest episode is titled The Phantom of the Bastille, and it tells you all you need to know about the infamous Comte de Loches. Who was this mysterious longtime prisoner? Who allegedly had spent over 30 years at the Bastille?
In The Art of Crime, you'll delve into the evolution of Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors, showcasing macabre curiosities and effigies of notorious criminals. Get ready for tales of the most divisive assassin of the French Revolution, the last man drawn and quartered for high treason in England, and the glamorous murderer who gained notoriety as a modern Lady Macbeth. Visiting the Chamber of Horrors was one of the first things I did on my very first trip to London.
You consider yourself a history buff or a true crime aficionado? Then The Art of Crime is a must listen. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and stay connected with them on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube for bonus content.
And don't forget to visit their website, artofcrimepodcast.com, for transcripts, bibliographies, and archival images for each episode. Immerse yourself in the stories where art, history, and true crime collide in the most unexpected ways.
Okay, back to our Valentine's Day. I think the most notorious crime associated with Valentine's Day is, of course, the Valentine's Day Massacre. This crime definitely stands as one of the most infamous events in the history of organized crime in the United States during the Prohibition era. And of course, it's named Valentine's Day Massacre because it occurred on Valentine's Day, on 14th of February 1929 in Chicago. This brutal and highly orchestrated act of violence sent shockwaves through the whole nation, revealing the ruthless power struggles between rival gangs and the escalating brutality of the Chicago outfit led by Al Capone. We already talked about Al Capone and the Prohibition a couple of times, so this is not going to be an in-depth story of the time, just some basic info. The Prohibition era, which lasted from 1920 to 1933, marked a time when the manufacturing, sale, and transportation of alcoholic beverages were illegal in the United States. As is often the case when you prohibit something, it becomes way more desirable, and so the Prohibition created a very lucrative and violent underground industry, leading to the rise of criminal organizations that sought control over the illicit trade of alcohol. You can compare it to the illegal drug trade and the violence associated with it that we know in modern days. Now, Chicago became a notorious hub of organized crime and the struggle for dominance between rival gangs, particularly Al Capone's Chicago outfit and the South Side Italian gang led by George Bugs Moran, reached a boiling point in the late 1920s. Quick side note, and fun fact or not so much fun fact, the far-right Austrian political party used the slogan Wien darf nicht Chicago werden, translates to Vienna mustn't become Chicago, during the elections in 1996. 1996, not 1926.
Wow.
Mm. Okay, so the setting for the St. Valentine's Day massacre was a garage at 2122 North Clark Street, which served as the headquarters for George Moran's gang. On the morning of 14th of February 1929, seven members of Moran's gang, along with an optician named Reinhard Schwimmer, who happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, were lined up against the wall and ruthlessly gunned down by four men using Tommy guns. The attackers, disguised as uniformed police officers, efficiently carried out the execution-style murders and left the scene without being apprehended.
This is from the Chicago Tribune, February 15, 1929, page 1. Quote, officials probe booze deals in gang shooting. Inquest today in seven deaths. In the state's attorney's investigation last night of the Northside Massacre, in which seven men were shot dead against a wall in a garage at 2122 North Clark Street yesterday morning, a dovetailing of underworld rumors developed a double motive. It is the police's belief that the gangsters who were killed paid the penalty for being followers of George Moran, successor to Dean O'Banion, the historic antagonist, as history goes, in the swift careers of gangsters, of the O'Banion-Moran crew, is Alphonse Capone, otherwise Al Brown. While that historic antagonism furnished the police a background of hate, jealousy, and revenge, it was also reported that a more immediate reason for the seven murders lies in a campaign of Moran's alcohol sellers to take liquor from Detroit sources and with it penetrate the bloody 20th Ward, the booze territory of the Capone gang. While the police, under Commissioner Russell and State Attorney Swanson, were hunting evidence, a special coroner's jury was impaneled by Coroner Bundensen to investigate the murders of the men listed, Dr. Reinhard H. Schwimmer, resident of the Parkway Hotel, an optometrist with offices in the Capitol building, had no criminal record, but was known as the companion of hoodlums, and was said to have boasted recently that he was in the alky racket, and could have anyone, quote, taken for a ride. Then it says, the article continues, seven hats are found. There were seven hats counted, significant but no help, as it would be hours, days, or perhaps weeks before the hats could be traced, and perhaps they never would be traced to their purchasers. Bullet marks on the wall, Captain Thomas Condon asks, and it is seen that few of the pellets missed their marks, for there were only seven or eight places where the detectives were sure bullets had struck. Over toward a little bench, a saw had been hanging on the wall, and the lower part of it had been broken off by a bullet. The police talk about Mexican firing squads, the Mexican standoff, they call it, and they expressed amazement that the seven could have been induced to face the wall and certain death without resistance. That bunch always went well-heeled, a policeman insists, and then Lieutenant Loftus states that he has picked up one revolver from the floor, he being the first policeman to arrive, and it had 6 unfired cartridges. The explanation was seen in the story of Mrs. Alphonsine Morin, who lives just across the street from the garage. She mentioned seeing men she thought were policemen coming out after hearing the shooting. Quote, 2 men in uniforms had rifles or shotguns as they came out the door, she said, and there were 2 or 3 men walking ahead of them with their hands up in the air. It looked as though the police were making an arrest, and they all got into an automobile and drove away. Quite simple, Chief Egan comments, they'd never have got that gang to line up unless they came in police uniforms. They wouldn't have got into the garage unnoticed, but it would appear that as policemen, they walked in and surprised the gang sitting there and waiting for a message or for orders. For policemen, the gang would line up and face the wall, and I suppose the fake policemen disarmed them before they lined them up. Then, when the stage was set, perhaps the other killers came in and took aim and started the machine gun and fired the shotguns, and then as a precaution against trouble, if they should meet policemen coming out, 2 or 3 of the killers put up their hands to indicate they were prisoners in custody of the police. End quote. Clever.
Very clever. Also, I mean, couldn't it have been that the police was like, that some policemen were on the payroll of Al Capone, probably, and...
Yeah, at that time.
Yeah.
Who wasn't on the payroll of Al Capone?
Exactly. So maybe they were not even fake policemen. Who knows? Who can say?
Who can say?
Who can say? Because the identity of the gunman was never definitely established, but it is widely believed that they were associates of Al Capone. The level of sophistication and coordination involved in the massacre suggested a high degree of planning and organization. The choice of disguises as police officers added a chilling layer of deception, and it not only allowed the gunmen to approach the victims with ease, but also sowed confusion among potential witnesses and law enforcement. The St. Valentine's Day massacre had significant implications for the organized crime landscape and law enforcement efforts in Chicago and beyond. It marked a turning point in the public perception of gang violence, prompting increased public outrage and demands for law enforcement action. The brutality of the massacre shocked the nation and exposed the ruthlessness of the criminal underworld, leading to heightened efforts to combat organized crime. So one consequence of the St. Valentine's Day massacre was increased pressure on law enforcement to address the issue of organized crime in Chicago, for example. The lack of convictions highlighted the challenges law enforcement faced in gathering evidence and building cases against powerful and well-connected criminal organizations. The Bureau of Investigation, which would later be known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, so the FBI, under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, intensified its efforts to investigate and prosecute members of organized crime. But the massacre also had repercussions within the criminal underworld itself. The elimination of several key members of Moran's gang weakened his position, and Al Capone's Chicago outfit emerged as the dominant force in the city's organized crime landscape. Capone, of course also known as Scarface, was already a notorious figure, but the St. Valentine's Day massacre solidified his reputation as a ruthless and cunning crime boss. In 1933, the 21st Amendment was ratified, repealing prohibition and ending the era that had given rise to the violent conflicts between rival criminal organizations.
Bostonians know there's a really great bar right around the corner from the State House called the 21st Amendment. I love that. Do you know I've never seen the movie Scarface? Have I told you that already?
You haven't? Which one? Which Scarface? You mean the original,
any
the Howard Hughes one?
Yeah, I've not seen any of them.
You should.
We'll watch. Yeah, I'll watch. I have a whole list of films I want to watch with you.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So what happened to old Snorky?
Snorky.
Is still my favorite thing. If you listen to the Amityville episodes, then you might remember that...
Is that when we... How do you remember that? Anything.
You remember that he had a... that's where he started out there. You remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Snorky was also one of Al Capone's nicknames, but that was one that only his friends were allowed to use, I think. which makes sense.
We're bringing Snorky back. It's the same thing I said last time.
He eventually was arrested and sent to prison, and most people will know this, but not for his ruthless and violent crimes, but for tax evasion. In 1931, the federal government decided to pursue charges of income tax evasion against Capone. The idea was basically to target him for financial crimes, which could be proven more easily than direct involvement in criminal activities. Frank J. Wilson, the chief investigator for the Internal Revenue Service, so the beloved IRS, played a crucial role in building the case.
We should talk about it briefly at the end of this. All right, go on. Because it is tax season.
So he played a crucial role in building the case against Al Capone. Wilson and his team meticulously examined Capone's finances, revealing a complex web of income and expenditures that had not been, what a big surprise, accurately reported to the government. Can you even imagine? And can you imagine how difficult it must have been to go through all of this financial situation?
Forensic accountants are amazing.
So the government's case hinged on proving that Capone had not paid income taxes on his very substantial earnings from illegal activities. In October 1931, a federal grand jury indicted Capone on 22 counts of income tax evasion for the years 1925 to 1929. During the trial, which began in October of 1931, the prosecution presented evidence of Capone's unreported income, including from bootlegging, gambling, and other criminal enterprises. Despite Capone's attempts to manipulate the legal proceedings and the jury, can you imagine the jury under how much pressure and fear they must have been?
Terrifying.
The evidence against him was overwhelming, and on 17th of October 1931, Al Capone was found guilty on 5 counts of income tax evasion. He was sentenced to 11 years in federal prison, fined $50,000, which is a lot of heirloom carpet money, and ordered to pay court costs, of course. Capone's appeal attempts were unsuccessful, and he began serving his sentence at the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta. In 1934, Capone was transferred to Alcatraz, the federal prison located on an island off the coast of San Francisco, infamous The Rock.
Love it.
Where his health deteriorated during his imprisonment, and he was released on parole in November of 1939 for medical reasons. Al Capone died on 25th of January 1947 in his home in Miami from complications of a syphilis infection. The house, by the way, had been demolished only in the last year. It was actually a very pretty house, judging from photos. Amazing view. It was on Palm Island, I think. I think it's such a shame. I read that 25,000 people signed a petition to save the house, but yeah, it's gone.
It's really sad. Yeah, the Al Capone case is not the only case where somebody really dangerous was caught for nonviolent activity, but I think that one is probably the most famous, right?
Definitely the most famous. Which other ones do you know? I'm trying to think of one on the off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are others, but I just can't think.
Yeah, it's all the RICO stuff. It's just so satisfying.
It's satisfying, but it's also kind of funny, and which is sad because, I mean, a lot of people died.
Yes. Yeah.
But then they get them for tax evasion on illegal income, which is... There was a podcast here from a female drug dealer. She was a female drug dealer in Vienna in the 1990s. It was a very interesting podcast. Well, she was arrested for... She was caught drug dealing. It was a... Yeah. But... After she was released from prison, she had tax debt. They taxed her for her illegal drug money income, which is...
I mean, to be fair...
It's so weird.
Yeah, but at least your prisons are nice. Like, your prisons are rehabilitative and your taxes go into that, you know? Here, it's like...
It's true.
So I can kind of understand that. I'm not mad about that. I'm not mad about her having to pay for her time in prison. Death and taxes, right? Speaking of taxes, how do taxes work in Austria? How do you pay your taxes each year?
Well, somebody who's an employee, not self-employed, pays the tax. It gets deducted automatically every month from your salary. You don't have to do anything. And now it's a new system where at the end of the year, they make your tax refund automatically and they give you back the money that they took too much.
Oh, so it's all automatic and you don't have to do anything?
For the podcast, I have to do it every year myself. Everybody who's self-employed has to do it. And then it depends on how much you earn per month. And if you earn over a certain amount, you have to do it every month. Otherwise, you just have to do it once a year.
Yeah, we don't earn enough to have to do anything.
No, there's no problem there.
No, we don't have to. We don't have to.
I don't have to pay taxes on this little income.
No, we don't make enough to make taxes. No, because by the time we've paid for
everything
we have to pay for, there's not really any money. It's fine. So here, and you may know this already, it's so stressful. So here, I don't know. You don't know what you owe.
Yeah.
The government knows.
But they don't tell
you. The government knows to the penny, to the cent, what you owe. They won't tell you. Listen, some people who have their act together can do their own taxes, or they have really simple situation and it's not a big deal. But if you have any kind of just normal kind of job with taxes and deductions and stuff, then you need to spend between $200 and $1,000 a year to have your taxes done by a professional. If you get it wrong, I think one time my taxes were off and I the check I sent in on taxes that year was like, I owed money because I want to say that's the year my aunt passed away. So we inherited a little bit of money. And when we paid our taxes, it was like $5 short. So then like 2 years later, I got a bill in the mail that was like, it was scary. It was like, this is how much you owe us now, because it's been compounded with interest and penalties on the $5. It's terrifying. So if you get it wrong, you could go to jail. But like, they get it wrong all the time.
Yeah.
And if they get it wrong, they're like, sorry, my bad. Here's $500 back. Our tax system is the worst. It's the worst.
The first year I had to do my own taxes, I was terrified. And you have a certain day and you have to do it before that, right?
Yeah, here too, April 15th.
And you have to do it online.
Oh, not here.
So I'm trying to get into my online account. I can't get in. So I request a new password. They send it to a wrong address. I finally get the password. I can't get in. I tried for I don't know how many times. So I have to make an appointment. That was during COVID. You couldn't just go to the tax office, make an appointment, because I can't get into my account. And I have 2 days left to do my taxes, right? And I'm panicking because I think financial police is going to come arrest me.
Mm-hmm.
So I get there. I tell them I need to get into my account. Okay, they give me a new password. I go home. I try to log in. I can't get in. Panic mode. I call again, get an appointment for the next day. I rush there. I tell them, I need to get into my account. I have to do it by today. And they're like, they were so nice. They were like, it's not that big of a deal. If you're late, you're late. If you can't get in, just take the paper form and fill it in and throw it into the mail. And it's all going to be fine. And then I told Philip, they were so nice at the tax office. And he's like, why wouldn't they be nice? They want your money.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Plus your taxes pay their salary.
And every year I'm like, this year I'm going to do my taxes early. And I never do.
No. No, I'm terrible. It's all so stressful to me that we have a professional, but then you still have to track things. Like all of my medical expenses are deductible.
Yeah.
Prescription copays, doctor's copays, dental work, which this year there's a lot of expensive dental work. That's all deductible. And then you can also deduct one of my favorite things. Would you ever have to pay for parking at a hospital?
Yeah. Not everywhere, but in the bigger ones. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. This drives my husband crazy that you have to pay for parking when you're at the hospital, paying out the wazoo to get treatment.
Yeah.
And then you're paying for parking in the parking garage. Yeah. So, but that's also tax deductible. So is mileage. So like if you have an infusion that's an hour and a half, 2 hours away from your house, you can track your mileage and that's tax deductible just for some of my...
you can deduct a lot of things.
The problem is in order for anything to be deductible, you have to owe a certain amount anyway. So unless you're really wealthy or do you know what I mean? It has to be such a gross chunk of your income that I don't know if there's any point, but I do. I try to track stuff.
So is this now an episode about taxes or Valentine's Day?
Both. Both.
I don't know. I used to be like super sarcastic about Valentine's Day or Mother's Day or these kind of things. I'm not big into these things. I'm more the kind of pragmatic person who's there all the time for their loved ones and who's there every single day. And I'm not saying people who celebrate Valentine's Day are not, but some are not.
Right. Oh, sure.
Some think, well, I gave you flowers for Valentine's Day. That's enough for the whole year. But most people obviously are not that. And I just talked to my friend Ingrid and she's a very big romantic and into Valentine's Day. And she really puts a lot of thought into it. And well, the way she sees it, why not also celebrate your love on one special day? And I think that's a nice way of looking at it, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm still not going to celebrate it because it's just not for me. And I'm glad Philip also agrees with it. If he would be into it, I would put in some effort, of course. I don't want to be this kind of sarcastic person anymore who looks down on people celebrating the things. Life is too fucking horrible most of the time. Just celebrate the things you want to celebrate and enjoy the things you enjoy.
Yes, I am with you. I am so over putting people down for things that bring them joy. You want Christmas stuff up all year? Leave it up all year. If you want, you know, whatever makes you happy in this really difficult world, like, do it.
Yeah.
Do it, you know?
I'd say that's it for today.
Oh, something good. Something good. You go first.
My birthday is coming up by the end of the month, and Philip he always has a hard time, like, he's great with gifts, but always my birthday being 2 months after Christmas is kind of a little bit difficult, right? And then he asked me what I want for my birthday, and I always say, I have everything I want. There's nothing I want. But he was stressed, and so I told him, you know what? I really would love to go see the Falco musical again for the third time.
Nice.
You know what? I would love to see it too. Let's buy tickets, and that's your birthday present. So that's my something good. We're going to watch the Falco musical again.
Oh, I love that.
It's so cool.
See, you don't do anything for Valentine's Day, so you don't have to feel guilty about doing something for your birthday.
True.
It's 2 months after Christmas. It's not like it's 2 weeks after Christmas.
No, it's just he has a hard time finding gifts then because he always goes all out for Christmas.
He does.
Yeah.
He really does. Yeah.
So that's my something good. How about you?
I just finished reading a book that I really, really enjoyed. I had a really sad week, obviously, and I'm going to talk more about that at a future date. But one thing that I really enjoyed is I finished a book called House in the Cerulean Sea. It's by T.J. Klune. I think it's a young adult book, but the basic premise is this island where there's an orphanage of magical people. And it's sort of a story about just belonging and finding your people. And you know how every so often you'll read a book and the whole thing is just lovely. It's like a cup of tea by the fire, this book. I just enjoyed it so much. It's not murdery, really. Although there is a young Lucifer in it. So there is that. But really enjoyed it.
Talking about reading, for everybody who's interested, I'm still going strong with my at least one chapter per day New Year's resolution. So gonna keep you updated. And that's it. If you enjoyed this rather lighthearted and chatty episode, please do us a huge favor, go to your podcast app, maybe Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, Spotify, YouTube. You can leave us comments and reviews and ratings everywhere. Go to our webpage, freshhellpodcast.com. There you find links to our merch store, to our Patreon, to our Facebook, to our email, which is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com, and to our PO box. And join us on our Facebook group. It's always lovely there. Lovely group of weirdos.
So nice. It's murder. It's all of the case stuff, but then old houses and interesting historical things and travel information. And it's great. Best people on the internet.
Please tell your pets we said hi. Hug them, cuddle them, take them to the vet if there's something wrong with them or for their checkups. And be kind to them. Be kind to your fellow human beings out there. And most importantly, be kind to yourself.
That's the hardest one, so, but try harder. Yeah. Try harder.
Do it.
Just do it. Be nice to yourself, all right? Come on already. Listen, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.
Happy Valentine's.
Happy Valentine's.